we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to Animal Voices, Western Canada's only radio program dedicated to animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Today is Friday, October the 20th, 2017. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here in the studio today by my co-hosts, Sinead Sanders.
Hello.
And our control room operator and co-host today, Amir Ali.
Good afternoon.
Welcome, everyone, and a special shout out to Ricardo, who is listening right now. So, what would happen if extinct species like dinosaurs or woolly mammoths were brought back to life? Science writer and documentarist Britt Ray tackles the science, ethics, and risks of de-extinction in her new book, Rise of the Necrofauna. We are fortunate to have her here in the studio with us later today to talk about this fascinating topic. That interview is coming up in about a half hour, so please do stay tuned. And also, our control room operator and co-host Amir will be having a special review of the French documentary film, The Valley of the Wolves, that he'll be sharing and discussing with us shortly as well. So I'm looking forward to that. But first, I wanted to talk about a topic that came up in my news feed this week. This was an article by the Vegan Lifestyle magazine online called Ecorazi. They put out some good articles, and this article came out, it was last year, but it's still completely relevant, and particularly relevant to me in our show, I think, because it's a post by a Dr. Frances McCormick, and she is speaking about how some vegans call vegan food cruelty-free, when in fact, if you really think about it, there's just because food doesn't have animal products in it, right? It doesn't mean it's completely cruelty-free. But I think so. I'm definitely guilty of calling food cruelty-free on the show, and the reason that I do that is because I'm thinking about our listeners who might just be, you know, the average person turning on the radio in their car or listening at work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're on the radio, you want to be clear, you want to be simplified. Sometimes the word, like, people don't identify with the word vegan, or you're using it too much because we're a vegan show, right? So I change it up, and sometimes I say cruelty-free food, where, in fact, not all vegan food is cruelty-free, and the reason for that is because there's a lot of other issues, specifically human rights issues, that come into play when you're creating food that doesn't have animals in it. You know, as vegans, we're doing as much as we can to the vegan ethic is to create as least harm as possible, right, when you're eating the food that you eat. And the way that we do that is to not eat food that contains any animal products or byproducts, such as dairy and cheese and honey and gelatin and whey and casein and all that icky stuff, right, that belongs to animals and not to us. But we also do need to be thinking into further issues, because I mean, in an ideal world, we want to be cruelty-free, right? So this is where we delve deeper and we think about issues to do with, such as human rights issues when chocolate is being made, right? Palm oil that is in so many different products and is destroying orangutan habitats. And we've talked about that on the show before. And in this article, I learned actually cashews are really big these days in vegan cuisine. Oh, I used a lot of cashews when I was doing my cooking last week. And did you know that cashews are often processed by people who receive caustic burns from the acids that lie between the two layers of the hard shell of the nut? And some cashews are produced in forced labor camps. I didn't know that. So, you know, it's a learning process. I don't claim to know everything, even though I call myself a vegan, but it's about doing the least harm, but doing the least harm knowledgeably so.
Yeah.
Right? So we have, and then there's other issues as well. Sinead, what are your thoughts about this and like how we use language, and we try to simplify things for like the radio, but it can maybe go in the wrong direction.
Yeah. I think that veganism itself is not really, it's not the end goal. Veganism is a means to an end, and means to the end of oppression and unnecessary harm. So it is a learning process all the way through. You don't just say, I'm vegan, so I'm perfect now. You know, it's like,
I agree.
You know, yeah. you say like, I'm vegan. I recognize that some things cause unnecessary harm, and I don't think I'm better than anybody else, any other animal or human who might be exploited for this product, so I don't want to be a part of it. But of course, these things are everywhere. So you know, we take the things that we know about, and you continue learning, and that's how it goes.
So Amir, what are your thoughts on using, like here on the radio, cruelty-free, like, I think I should be more careful about that because I don't want to diminish the struggles of humans that I was reading. You know, I know about some of them, but reading about in this article as well, you know, people not receiving, farm workers not receiving fair wages, and coffee is an issue as well. It's technically vegan, but there's a lot of...
I was actually going to mention coffee because I drink a lot of coffee, and obviously there are a lot of very grave human rights concerns in terms of the way coffee is produced, and I do try my best to go to places that do have, you know, fair trade and that kind of thing in terms of coffee.
Because you have that choice and you can do that.
Yeah.
You're empowering your lifestyle choices.
Yeah, and I mean, we're really lucky in Vancouver that way to know where a lot of our stuff comes from. People living in other parts of the world might not be so lucky. But yeah, you're right. It's definitely not something I think about enough. It's something that I've thought about in the past and I've kind of let slip because it's, I don't know, it's just not something that I put a lot of mental effort into. But it is something that I want to put more effort into thinking about consciously in my day-to-day life.
I think most of the time when this, well, not most, of, a lot of the time when this comes up in conversation, people bring it up with me when they're saying, oh, well, you know, you're vegan, but where did those chocolate chips come from in your vegan cookies? Or, you know, and they bring it up as like this aha thing. And it said that in that article,
that.
Like, it's not a gotcha sort of argument. It's like, oh, well, your stuff causes suffering too. So there's no, so like, I'm justified in buying bacon and dairy products. You know, it's not that kind of argument, but it is something that we should be aware of because, you know, we're saying we're trying to promote the idea of rights for animals and humans are animals. So human rights are animal rights.
That's what my car says. Yeah. It's true. So exactly. And I want to say too that, you know, all three of us here, we identify as being vegan, but we also just said we're not perfect, right?
Oh yeah.
Being vegan is living a vegan lifestyle is an evolution.
Yeah.
And I'm learning all the time. And so even just reading this article the other day that someone had posted, it made me think because I am aware of issues. It's just a matter of growing your awareness so that you can incorporate that as part of your daily ethic, right?
Yeah.
For us being vegan, as we are, not consuming animal products, it's just a normal daily thing, right? And we're used to it and it's not that hard, but then we can challenge ourselves a little bit more to grow more knowledgeable, to become more aware.
And that's what we ask other people to do when we're promoting veganism.
Right.
We're asking with animals. And for us, you know, we've educated ourselves on these issues where animal products come from. And so we're saying, hey, this is unnecessary and it's not in line with my values, so I'm not going to support it anymore. And we're saying, hey, maybe these don't align with your values either, so maybe you don't want to support it. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to keep finding things this stuff about cashews and stuff where we're going, okay, that also is not in line with my values and I do not need that. So,
and that's just I think, Allison, you touched on it. It's an evolution, a learning process. I think we should always try as best as we can to learn as much as possible about where everything that we consume, you know, comes from.
Yeah, we don't yet live in a vegan world, but perhaps it's coming, and we can always strive for that to be an end goal. So I guess to conclude, when we talk about cruelty-free food, I think it's really important, critical to choose your words wisely, and I definitely will be thinking about that in my communication on the radio, as I hope you too will as well,
for sure.
Because it's now come to our awareness. So moving on, I have some news. What's my news here? So there's some interesting news that happened this week, some that sort of correlates with each other. So this week, the city of Delta, which is it's like a suburb of Vancouver, if people don't know, they made a decision to limit the sale of cats, dogs, and rabbits to adoptions from approved shelters and rescues. Wow. And this comes into effect really soon. I think next week, November 1st. So in a week and a half. So that's a big move. SPCA Manager of Public Policy and Outreach Amy Morris says that the new bylaw approved by Delta Council this week is a step forward in preventing animal cruelty. Sure it is. So she says that the restriction also reduces the issues that can arise from multiple purchases of domestic animals. And with so many cats and rabbits being abandoned and surrendered to shelters and rescues, this is the right move. So interestingly enough, the Canadian Kennel Club and Cat Fanciers Association do not allow breeders to sell to pet stores in their code of ethics. So I appreciate that. They're moving in the right direction. And then also this week, same thing is happening in the whole state of California. California will soon implement a new statewide ban on sales of animals commercially raised in puppy mills. And same thing, they're going to be promoting rescues. And we've talked about this on the show before, that I learned in an interview we did with Nathan Winograd years ago. This always stuck with me, that he said that for all the dogs and cats in shelters in North America, there are just as many people who are looking for dogs and cats for companion animals. So why don't we just delete the actual like breeding and pet store part of the equation and get the rescued animals to the people who want animals, mm-hmm. right? That makes just so much more sense.
Yeah, that's great news that this is spreading around.
And this is all of California. So this bill was just signed into law last Friday, and it's going to be making it illegal for pet stores to sell dogs, cats, and rabbits from any source other than a shelter or a rescue group. Now, whereas the law in Delta comes into place almost immediately, this law in California won't go into effect until 2019. I'm not sure why it's taking so long. That's always the part that sort of it stumps me as to why that would take so long, right?
Yeah. Money.
In the meantime, all of these dogs and cats are going to be euthanized in shelters.
I think the other issue is, though, like I used to be with a dog walker, and there's a lot of people that have these pets that need a specific kind of breed or something, and they need these specialized kinds of, you know, dogs, and it's awful. But
sorry, what did you say? There's pets that need breeds?
No,
there's people.
People that need to have these specialized breeds.
Why do they need them? So this is why. So the American Kennel Club, they are actually standing against this statewide regulation, and they say it not only interferes with individual freedoms of humans, of course, it also increases the likelihood that a person will obtain a pet that is not a good match for their lifestyle, and the likelihood that the animal will end up in a shelter. So I disagree with that statement, because from what I know and from what I just said, I always tell people, you can get any breed of animal that you want from a rescue shelter. There are specific rescues for specific breeds for people. As you, Amir, said, there are certain people that need, in quotes, a certain type of breed. I don't really, I mean, people have their preferences, sure, but I think we need to get away from thinking as, you know, pets aren't your commodity to have as a treat.
Shouldn't be a status symbol to have a certain type
like,
of breed.
I need a bulldog.
I need that handbag.
It's awful.
What it is they're companion animals, and you should have a need to make a difference in someone's life and rescue this animal that will have a much better life with you than either staying forever in a shelter or being put to sleep. So moving on from the West Coast to the East Coast, guess what? The circus is over for elephants in the state of New York.
Hooray.
That was big news this week. So as we know, Ringling Brothers shut down in this past year, and we're so happy about that. Well, this week, the Elephant Protection Act was signed into law. It prohibits the use of elephants in entertainment acts, including circuses, carnivals, parades, and trade shows. That's pretty much everything, right? Like, it's wonderful that they're being so progressive. So Governor Cuomo, who signed in the law, he said that the use of elephants in these types of settings is dangerous to their health and potentially abusive. No kidding. We know that, right?
Yeah.
The Elephant Protection Act furthers this administration's effort to fight animal cruelty and create a stronger, more humane New York. So that's great news. So in creating a stronger, more humane New York, I want to see them also abolish the horse carriages in New York. So that day will come.
So I guess now moving on to, it is Wolf Week.
National Wolf Week.
Yeah, I'm not really too
sure. Wolf Awareness Week.
Wolf Awareness Week, for sure. A couple of weeks back, I went in to the VIF at SFU, the Hastings Theater, and got to see a movie by a filmmaker, Jean-Michel Bertrand, called The Valley of the Wolves. Allison, I don't know what your experience was like, but my experience just at VIF,
Vancouver International Film Festival,
it was
which
a really
just ended.
Yeah, it was a really cool experience, actually.
Yeah, I watched Okja. It was fun.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
When I was in Toronto, actually, I remember TIFF, and it was very corporatized, and I felt like VIF was a little more intimate and grounded, which I actually enjoyed a lot. This film is actually somewhat of a spiritual successor to another movie by the same filmmaker about eagles called Flirting with Heights, and it's going to be followed up with another movie in sort of like a trilogy about wolves as well. But let's get into it. This movie is about animals, about wolves, obviously, and it being Wolf Week, that's why we're talking about this movie, but it has little to no relevance, in my mind, to animal rights outside of the theme of the movie, which obviously is a bit of a confounding thought, but I'll explain what I mean. Before the movie started, the director, with the translator, he's French, gave a brief synopsis of the film. And there are certain aspects of the movie that I didn't really appreciate, but again, we'll get into that. My expectations of this film in terms of content, I had little to no knowledge going into it and expected there to be some subtext regarding the impact we as humans have had on wolf populations. But he didn't really touch on that too much. He kind of stayed away from the political aspect of wolves, and I think that was to further his creative vision for the movie. Like I mentioned, the movie was entirely in French, but there's not really a lot of dialogue. If you've seen Planet Earth or any movies like that, it was kind of had that vibe.
Subtitles?
Yeah, there were subtitles. The setup for the movie was there's this man, the filmmaker, who is on a quest to find wolves in this remote part of the Alps. The movie actually spans over the course of 3 years. He had a home base that he would go back to, and he spent like a week at a time in certain areas where he camped out in. So he does kind of touch on the fact when he first gets up into the mountains that something had happened that caused wolf populations to dwindle. But again, he doesn't really get too specific about what happens. So upon first exploring the first area that he camps up in, there are no wolves to be found. But he does encounter a pile of droppings, which he is very excited about. This man loved his poop. He proceeds to set up camp, literally, in different parts of this remote land. And he had these really, really cool motion-activated cameras, which he attached to the trees. You get to see the raw feed of these tapes as he reviews them back at his base. And you see a wide variety of animals. There's some deer, squirrels, chipmunk. The wild hogs were really playful. And he had some amazing footage of owls, actually. And he kind of sort of played with them. They were very curious and quirky. But again, not a wolf to be found. Eventually, as he explores more and more camps and new places, he finds more evidence that there are wolves that exist out here. But we don't really see many of them till the eventual climax of his first wolf sighting on camera. You get the sense that this experience for him was somewhat of a roller coaster ride, though, because he finds some evidence and then he goes, you know, weeks or maybe longer than that without seeing anything.
So the suspense is building.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, one of the reviews that I read about this actually considered it to be a bit of a thriller, which how they build up the build up to the actual wolf sightings. But again, he spent lots of time with nothing, and you kind of see him being discouraged a little bit. Further into the movie, this is the one area that kind of disappointed me. He has a couple of horses at his home base, and he eventually, because it's a lot of work for him to lug up all his equipment up and down, uses his horses to help him carry his equipment up and down the mountain. And so I don't know what your thoughts are about this, but for me, it was kind of hard watching these horses do this hard work for him. But at the same time, he did seem to have a really good bond with these horses. The horses seemed to really appreciate him. And Allison, I don't know how you feel about people riding horses, but that I think in general, animal rights activists probably don't agree with people riding horses, do they?
Well, I have conflicted feelings because I'm not very well educated on the subject,
same.
And that's why we are going to do a show about that in the mm-hmm. future with people that can speak about it more knowledgeably. My conflicted feelings are that, when I see those poor horses being worked so hard, and also in films like movies,
definitely.
Dramas as well, because they're actually doing that in mm-hmm. most cases, I feel bad for them. But you are asking me about horseback riding because there's people who say that they have special bonds with their horses and that it's a mutual relationship. And I can't say no, it's not, right? Because I don't know, I'm not in that. So that's why I want to explore that further, definitely, on another show.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it was interesting for me to leave the film and be about wolves and thinking more about horses.
Yeah.
But, I'll continue on. Eventually, he does camp out in an area where one of his motion-activated cameras does pick up some wolves, and obviously he's really excited now. He eventually sets up camp in this area where he's a fair distance away from the wolves. It's not really their den or their common area where they hang out, but it's an area where they pass through a lot. And eventually he makes eye contact with one of these wolves, and you just see how majestic and beautiful these animals are.
Wow.
There's no aggressiveness from the wolves. They're actually just, like, watching. Eventually they sort of get used to his presence there and go on about their daily lives. But if I could pause for a moment from the review, obviously it being Wolf Week, I'm reminded of when we did a show a couple years back mm-hmm. About the wolf call that was going on.
In BC.
In
still
BC,
happens.
Yeah. When many people think of a wolf, they may think of a brutal, aggressive, and violent animal, but I think our perceptions are very misguided because wolves are just like us, just like any other animal in the wild. There's a mom and a dad. They've got a family to feed.
They're pack animals, just like humans, and we can identify more with wolves than other animals because we live with dogs who are ancestors of wolves.
Yeah.
Domesticated dogs are like wolves. If our domesticated dogs become feral, they basically become like wolves.
Yeah, and more importantly, they have a family to protect, and a wolf needs to do a lot more than a human being does to protect his or her family, because for the most part, we as human beings aren't in danger of being hunted or in danger of having our species wiped out. So I think wolves aren't any more dangerous than any being on this earth who feels threatened, including humans. He eventually found a pack of six of the most beautiful cubs in an area that seemed like more of a common gathering place for the cubs. And this seemed to be the height of his discovery in this three-year quest. He kept a safe distance from these cubs, and he finally got to this point he was praying and hoping to get to this entire film. He got some footage from a distance where his presence was completely hidden just for a few moments, and then he turned back and ended his entire expedition. And this is when he revealed his central theme. The less interference, the less of our existence as humans that these beautiful animals are exposed to, the better it will be for them, their livelihoods, and their strength as a species. So I thought that it was a very great way to end the film because it gave people the message that, you know, we shouldn't be meddling with the lives of these animals that are just trying to live their own lives in the wild.
And we can apply that to all other species as well. It's kind of a nice theme, very poignant, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What do you think, Sinead?
Yeah, I think it blows my mind actually about wolves because as you said, they're one of the more familiar wild animals to us just because they are, that's where
and
dogs
admired
came
too.
From.
Admired.
Yeah, you know, and mm-hmm. so growing up, people around me, I never knew anybody to have these vicious views of wolves, and it wasn't until I did some reading and I realized how widespread that is, especially in the United States, or from what I've read in the United States, like the amount of people who are just, wolves are horrible and we need to shoot them all. It's like, really? You know?
And especially this time of year, because obviously Halloween's coming up and wolves and werewolves and stuff. I'm sure that doesn't help the perceptions that people have of wolves at all.
If people are interested in knowing more information about the BC wolf call in British Columbia, check out our website. We've covered it several times before, animalvoices.org. There's info on there, and no doubt we'll probably be discussing it again later this year as it will inevitably come up again.
And so again, if you are interested in watching this film, the film is called The Valley of the Wolves. The filmmaker is Jean-Michel Bertrand. It seemed like he had a huge following at VIF. It was a packed house, and the Q&A afterwards, it seemed like a lot of these people that had gone to see the film were a really big fan of his.
That's really cool. I really love supporting the community arts in that way, and I'm really glad we could be a part of VIF this year.
So yeah, we should definitely keep doing this. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for that film review.
Yeah, no problem.
So now we have some upcoming events, and this one's for you, Sinead. Do you want to go to a beer and burger day that's
yeah,
all vegan?
For $10? Yes, I do.
Yeah, 10 bucks too. So that's happening on Saturday, October the 28th. It seems like it's just a one-day special event. It's happening at Doan's Craft Brewing Company in Vancouver. So we know here about the very good butchers. They are a plant-based, vegan, and organic butcher shop based in Victoria, BC. I've had the pleasure of eating some of their sausages that I got from Vegan Supply. They are really yummy. And they have a store in Victoria, and they're bringing their hot dogs and their burgers to this event. So once again, Saturday, October the 28th, Doan's Craft Brewing Company in Vancouver, $10, and they will give you a burger, a hot dog, and some beer. Another event that's coming up that's also to do with vegan food is a plant-based cuisine class. This is happening at Tao Organics in North Vancouver. Cafe Tao happens to be definitely one of my top two places to eat in Metro Vancouver area. They're mostly all raw, all organic, delicious, delicious food just off Lonsdale in Vancouver, in North Vancouver. This event is happening on Wednesday, November the 1st from 8 to 9:30 p.m. and it's going to be a food preparation class. You're going to learn how to make buckwheat flatbread and jelly rolls. So to find out more, you can register on their website at taoorganics.com/classes. And Tao is, I think it's pronounced Dao, actually. I always pronounce it wrong, but it's spelled T-A-O, then organics.com/classes. So you'll learn how to make bread, but it's not going to have gluten, granulated sugar, dairy, or fat in it. So is it possible? That's the question that they pose. Yes, it is. And that sounds like it's going to be fun. I would totally support that. The price is $40 per person or $70 for two people. And once again, that's Wednesday, November the 1st. And for another upcoming event that I really wanted to promote, it's the second annual Dairy Free Living event, which is happening on Sunday, November the 5th from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Vancouver Central Public Library hosted by EarthSave. They had their first one last about a year and a half ago, and it was so well attended, actually, that it sold out. So this event is being coordinated by the Vegan Project in Fresh and Fit Vancouver, and it will be education by four speakers on how and why to explore a dairy-free diet, as well as it will boast some pretty yummy dairy-free goodies provided by local vendors. And I know last time they had like a large array of all different kinds of non-dairy, vegan cheeses and milks and everything else that you can think of. Like, there's a lot of good stuff there. So the speakers will be Bridget Gem. She was the organizer last time. Anna Pippas from Animal Justice, who will speak about thriving on a vegan diet during pregnancy, breastfeeding, and infancy. Karen McCaffey from Blue Heron Creamery, who we had on the show earlier this year. She'll be talking about the art of plant-based cheesemaking and doing a demo. Nikki Hurst, who from Veganomical Living, who we also had on the show recently. She'll be speaking about the benefits of the plant-based sources of vitamins and minerals found in dairy milk and why choosing this option is optimal for health. She's a nutritionist. So this half-day course will once again take place at the Vancouver Public Library in the Alice McKay Room, and it's open to everyone. But like I said, get your tickets soon because it did sell out last year. Tickets are $15. For more information, you can visit dairyfreeliving.ca and buy your tickets fast, like I said. And I think I have time for one more quick event. There is going to be a chicken nugget eating contest on Saturday, November the 11th. So who wants to go to that in terms of a disruption? So when you see an event like this, you think, oh, I don't want to like participate it other than if I'm disrupting it. So that's what's going to be happening. There's a disruption going to take place there, just like there was at the bacon eating contest last weekend that I didn't get to. I think Jen went to it, so maybe she can fill me in later on what happened there. So we all know that chickens are not nuggets. And if you believe the same thing, please show up. This is happening at Central Park in Burnaby, Saturday, November the 11th, from noon till 3 p.m. There will be a lot of other animal activists there from Vancouver Chicken Save. So if you have an animal rights-related event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
So Halloween is just around the corner, and from The Walking Dead to Resurrection, folks at this time of year are particularly fascinated by stories of what happens when the dead return to the world of the living. But what about when an entire species is revived? De-extinction is a story we've heard in Hollywood as well, most notably through the Jurassic Park franchise. But our feature guest today is here to talk about de-extinction in real terms. Britt Ray is a science journalist from Ontario, and her new book is called Rise of the Necrofauna, The Science, Ethics, and Risks of De-Extinction. Hello, Britt, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Hey, thank you.
Great to have you here, Britt.
It's great to be here.
It's also a great title, by the way.
Oh, yes. Thank you. It's a little macabre.
Yeah.
So to start off, one of the first things you explain in your book is that the term de-extinction is actually somewhat misleading. When we're talking about bringing a species back to life, we're not really speaking literally, are we? Can you tell us what's meant by the term de-extinction?
Sure, yeah. The reason why it's misleading is because it suggests that maybe we could undo extinction and reverse the erasure of a whole species, which we can't for a variety of biological reasons. Instead, de-extinction is about creating close versions or proxies or facsimiles of extinct species by using artificial selection methods, cloning, or gene editing in order to get there. So you can basically get a very close model without getting the carbon copy of the original species back.
Mm-hmm. And dinosaurs, then, are not on the table, you also explained pretty early. And so can you tell us why that is?
Yeah, sure. So dinosaurs are what we think of first because of Jurassic Park, for example. But the thing with dinosaurs is that they've been missing for nearly 66 million years. That is so long ago that when we do have their fossilized remains and try to extract useful bits of DNA from them, we can't. It's so brittle, broken up, decomposed, that we can't actually salvage any of its DNA code, which is the first ingredient you need in order to do any kind of realistic de-extinction. The oldest animal that scientists have been able to extract DNA from is a 700,000-year-old horse, and that's only a very small fraction of the amount of time that dinosaurs have been missing, so that's why it's impossible for that guy.
Yeah. All right, so how popular an idea is this among scientists? How many de-extinction projects are there happening around the world today?
I will try to count them on my two hands. There's not a ton. It's relatively fringe, but there are several of different types of species. So we've got the woolly mammoth project, the passenger pigeon, heath hen, aurochs, quagga, gastric brooding frog. There was a former project on the Tasmanian tiger, a.k.a. thylacine, and the Bucardo, which was the only successful de-extinction project to date. It's also known as a Pyrenean ibex. It's a type of mountain goat that lived in Spain. That might be most of them.
All right. So how are these species being chosen out of thousands of animals that have gone extinct? What's motivating scientists to focus on the animals you just mentioned?
Well, there's a mix between personal experience and falling in love with certain species when they were a child, for example, all the way into thinking about what that could do for an ecosystem if we had a close version of them back. So the overarching justification that gets used to say why de-extinction might be a good thing for conservation is that if you have an ecosystem that once housed an important keystone species that was really beneficial for keeping dynamics between the animals and plants and all sorts of other critters flourishing well there, and then it disappears, then you have a breakdown of these fundamental relationships in an ecosystem and its productivity. Mm-hmm. So if you get a version of that extinct species back in there that can carry out that beneficial ecosystem role, maybe you can increase the health and productivity of the ecosystem.
Yeah.
So having said that, I'm interested to know, like, how would that work with having the woolly mammoth back, who's been gone for millions and millions of years, and we've had climate change since then, and how would a woolly mammoth fit into our ecosystem?
Well, the woolly hasn't been gone that long. It's been gone from about 3,500 years plus. There are actually people building the pyramids when the last woolly mammoth lived, which is quite bizarre to think about.
I absolutely did not know that.
That's okay. Yeah, I mean, they seem very ancient to us.
Okay, still a long time ago, though. Like, can we just, so this is what I'm wondering is, because our environment and our ecosystems, they, when we lose species, they, you know, they adjust, right? And so the ecosystems are used to not having the species anymore. So if you then plug in an animal that used to be there, what happens?
Yeah, I mean, this is an issue I explore in the book, that it's, depending on how you look at it, quite unecological to say that you could just bring an animal back into an ecosystem, it's going to revert to what it was once like, because we don't have drag and drop ecosystem dynamics. You know, it's adapting to the change as soon as the animal disappears. But those working on the woolly mammoth say that it would be beneficial to actually fight devastating effects of climate change. And it's not an intuitive connection, but to explain it, I have to back up and just talk about where the mammoths used to live, and that's in the Arctic, places like the Yukon here in Canada, but also Siberia. And the Arctic is filled with enormous swaths of land that is filled of permafrost. And the permafrost contains millennia's worth of dead animals that have basically collapsed into the ground, been locked up in the soils, as well as all the vegetation they fed on. So there's just a ton of carbon in there. Mm. And we're learning that permafrost isn't actually permanently frozen. So it's kind of a bad word for the soil. Because of climate change, things are warming and they're thawing. And then as the soil thaws, it's releasing that carbon into the atmosphere, which is dangerous because there's twice as much carbon in these Arctic permafrost soils as there is currently in our warming atmosphere. Wow. And as that happens, microbes that are everywhere chew away at it, and they turn that carbon store into methane or carbon dioxide. So two of the greenhouse gases that got us into this mess.
Right.
And that exacerbates warming. So people are trying to keep that permafrost locked up however they can, keep it frozen. And the idea is that having a bunch of woolly mammoths back would be able to punch big holes in the snow as they walk around and search for blades of grass to eat in the winter months when there's not that much activity on the snow right now. There's a big thick insulating blanket, and that keeps things warmer. So if they're lumbering around with their big feet, that basically punches through the hole and creates these vents for cold frigid air from the atmosphere to come down, reach the top of the soil, and allow this freezing cycling of air. And not only that, because elephants, we know, are pretty aggressive and they're related, they could hopefully, is what the scientists want, knock over big trees and eat the dark plants that absorb more sun and then fertilize the soil with their dung to create more light reflective grasses and carry out this role that would slowly help it stay colder there.
Yeah, that was really interesting reading about that in your book. And one of the people who are working on de-extincting the woolly mammoth is George Church, professor of genetics at Harvard University and also an ethical vegan, so he gets a shout out for that.
True, he is, yeah.
He said that he predicts that they'll have a mammoth elephant embryo by 2019. Is that right?
Yeah, he has said that.
Yeah, but of course, having an embryo by 2019, it's still a long ways from having a herd of mammoths walking around.
Yeah. I mean, if he's successful to basically edit woolly mammoth specific genetic changes into an Asian elephant embryo by that date, which is pretty much around the corner, elephants have a 22-month gestation period compared to our human 9 months, so that's pretty long. And then, you know, that's got to be tried many times until it happens perfectly and animals can be born safely and healthily. because we know that there is a lot of experimentation that's needed, and it's hard to just get this working quickly. But then if you want to be able to make a self-sustaining population, they're going to have to manage themselves and reproduce themselves, and they're going to have to sexually mature, which takes like 15, 16 years for an elephant. So potentially it's something similar for the woolly mammoth. So you can see that it's quite a long-term project.
Yes, yeah. So these are long-term projects that obviously cost a lot of time and money and effort. Why spend all these resources bringing back animals that are already gone instead of protecting the many that we're still at risk of losing then?
Well, it's interesting because De-Extinction wants to double dip. They basically started as focusing on extinct species, but they've realized these tools, cloning, gene editing, for example, can be galvanized and applied to endangered, threatened populations too. So they can basically restore animals that are functionally extinct in the wild by using their last remaining individuals. Let's say there's three, such as the northern white rhino, and then using gene editing to edit more genetic diversity into their populations using long dead rhino tissue from animals that had more genetic diversity than the ones that are currently suffering because of low genetic diversity, and then cloning them and allowing them to boost their populations.
Humans have a long history of exploiting other animals, and in spite of the initial costs of developing this technology, there's of course the potential for money to be made from bringing back extinct species. Cows or cattle are among the most heavily exploited and consequently abused animals on the planet today. One of the species that's being looked at for de-extinction, as you mentioned, is the aurochs, which is the ancestor of all modern cattle. And they went extinct almost 400 years ago due to unrestricted hunting and habitat loss from farming and diseases transmitted by domesticated cattle. So why bring the aurochs back? Are we just inviting them to endure the same suffering as the majority of cattle are today?
That's an interesting question. There are a few different groups working on backbreeding the aurochs. So this is a fairly low-tech version of de-extinction where, similar to the way that we bred dogs from wolves, it's about selecting traits in cattle that we see today that resemble the extinct aurochs, so the right horn shape and size and coloration, things like this, and then over successive generations breeding them together until you arrive at something that looks and acts like the extinct aurochs, or at least what we think it acted like, because it was quite a long time ago, as you mentioned. So here, there is a group that I've written about in the book that wants to bring a sense of nature back to Europe, where a lot of the land there has been developed. There's not a lot of natural wilderness. We're very lucky here in British Columbia to be able to have these wild lands, but in Europe, it's not the case so much. So what they want to do is create these nature tourism parks that attract people to them in order to get a sense of this rewilded nature that can have these extinct proxies of these, you know, impressive cattle running around. And also they have a business model in place where they want to slaughter the males every 3 years for their wilderness meat. So they're, as you bring up, is it going to lead to more exploitation? Well, this project seems to really be in the service of human ideals of bringing people in as tourists, restoring some sense of nature that I guess people could profit from because they could make money from it, and then also provide a new source of meat, which we don't really need, in my opinion.
I think in your book I read there the True Nature Foundation slogan is from restoration to revenue, and I thought, oh, that sounds so ominous. Yeah, Allison, you had a question?
I'm wondering if you could explain a little bit more about how this works with, I was reading in an article, just like how does it work with cell cultures? I'm presuming this is, and there's test animals. Like how, and you're explaining about how, like, you're not going to get the exact genetic material that would be exactly like an animal that's already gone extinct.
Right.
So how does that work? Like, what's missing? So from what I understand, it's like, so for example, I was reading like birds are dinosaurs. So there's being work done on birds to sort of try to create a dinosaur. Like, sounds kind of like Frankensteinish, like just trying to like manipulate, I don't know, like maybe bones and muscle tissue. But there's more to it than that when it comes to trying to recreate something that's been dead for many years. And so can you explain a bit more about that?
Mm-hmm. So cloning is one method that's being used. Yeah. And here, this is the same method that gave us Dolly the sheep back in the 90s, that famous clone. And there's a process called somatic cell nuclear transfer. It's also what happened the one time that de-extinction did work with this Bucardo that I mentioned. So before the last Bucardo died, some cells had been preserved and frozen from its ear and its flank. And when cells are frozen very quickly, they can be frozen perfectly intact, so they have all of their DNA packaged up nice and neat, and it's not degrading. And in order to clone, you need a perfectly intact cell because you want to yank out the nucleus from that cell, which has most of the DNA of the organism in it. And then you take a donated egg from another animal. If it's for de-extinction, you take its closest living relative and a cell from it, an egg cell. You remove its native nucleus and you replace it with the nucleus from that animal you want to clone. So now you've got an egg cell with the DNA package from the extinct animal, and you can stimulate it to start dividing with an electroshock and implant it in a surrogate mother, where it will grow in that womb-like environment into the clone. And this raises the first huge animal welfare issue in de-extinction, because it doesn't just work like that in a jiffy. It takes a lot of trials. I mean, with Dolly the sheep, there were over 277 attempts to make the one sheep that we all know about, and the rest we forget about. We don't talk about it. We mask it, right? And with the Bucardo, there were 57 implantations of these cloned embryos that were made this way that produced 7 pregnancies, of which only one of them took, to then give birth to a clone that died 10 minutes later after it was born because it had a congenital disease and a deformity on its lung, which is the kind of imperfect complexity that comes sometimes with these high-tech methods of animal creation. So animal welfare, I think, is one of the realistic big ethical issues in de-extinction until they could get other methods that work very quickly. And then another approach is gene editing. And here you have basically the embryo of a close living relative to the extinct animal, so an Asian elephant, for example. And if you have the assembled genome, so nearly the total complete collection of DNA of the extinct mammoth, which we do, we've mapped it out, and you can understand which parts of it code for woolly mammoth-specific traits that elephants don't have, so things like the code that made the thick, iconic shaggy fur, and also the ability for it to live in the cold and bind and release oxygen in its blood at cold temperatures so it could live there, these types of traits, then you can use these biotech tools called gene editors, and there's a very fancy popular one now called CRISPR-Cas9 that everyone's using. And it's basically these this enzyme system that works like molecular scissors that you can use to target specific parts of an organism's DNA, and it could cut out a variant that's unique to the Asian elephant and replace it with the variant of DNA that's unique to the woolly mammoth. So you start to cobble together the genes of the woolly mammoth in the Asian elephant embryo. And then when you're satisfied, you've got enough of your genes in there that you need to make the animal you want to make, you can implant that embryo in a surrogate mom or potentially an artificial womb, which is what George Church's lab is also trying to create because of animal welfare issues. They say elephants are endangered. We should free up their uteruses to make more elephants, not these experimental animals.
Right.
So leave them to make their own kind, and then we'll create an artificial womb where we can grow these mammoth hybrids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one thing that was mentioned in your book was Neanderthals and how technically speaking, perhaps, you could take Neanderthal DNA and you could splice it together and you could be growing a Neanderthal human hybrid in a human uterus, but you'd have to have that.
There was a movie about that.
And,
remember?
And yeah, I can't remember who says it in the book, but they were saying how public opinion would have to change a lot before someone was ready
we
to
would
do that.
Allow Neanderthals because in society.
Well, yeah, and even just
although it's argued that
there
we
are
have,
some
we
among
have
us.
I was just thinking about it in terms of, you know, we're subjecting other animals to this exact process, but when we're talking about doing it with ourselves and taking our ancestors or whatever, you know, and going through this experience ourselves and giving birth to this someone who's not of your own species, you mm-hmm. know, we think it's absurd, but then we do it, we subject other right. animals to the same process.
I also feel it's like that Stephen King book/movie where they're a pet cemetery bringing dogs back from the dead, but the dog was never really like their sweet family
no.
dog ever again.
No.
I feel like it's cutting, as you were saying, with like you're chopping with your fingers here, it's cutting and pasting cells together, but what about the soul of the animal? Like, how can you create that? Like, is that an ethical issue that's being discussed?
I've never heard any scientists use the word soul
yeah.
in
yeah.
conversations of de-extinction.
They don't recognize that.
But what they do recognize, which is kind of getting to your point, is that we can't actually get the full essence of the original animal
exactly.
back because there's more to an animal than just its genome sequence, right? It depends on the environment in which it grows and which it lives. And if the original environment is 10,000 years old, that's not the environment we have for it today. And that's going to shape the overall essence of what it is.
Yeah, yeah, definitely not that simple. So yeah, you mentioned early in your book that dinosaurs are not in the cards for de-extinction, but that being said, once this technology is developed, is there anything stopping people from claiming patents on animals and creating zoo-like exploitative Jurassic Park scenarios with other animals?
We hope that measures will be put in place to prevent that kind of unecological use of their life once they're made. However, no. I mean, because of the high degree of biological engineering that's required, a lot of these animals in various nations will not be seen as a product of nature. And you can't patent a product of nature, for example, in the United States. And that means, therefore, when they're engineered, you can patent them because they're this kind of invention. There's an inventive step to making them. And when that happens, then there's an exclusive market put on whoever owns that patent. They can decide who can license that patent from them, make money off of it. So if there's someone with deep enough pockets who wants to do something and they want to license that patent, perhaps they could then permit their own mammoths. But the idea of the scientists working on this is that no, I mean, this is going to be for conservation or nothing at all. However, we've seen in the past that capital-driven interests can change the course of plans, and we need to be aware that these animals are likely going to be able to be patented because they're biologically engineered organisms.
Mm-hmm. The laws in the United States are different than in Canada as far as patents go, right?
Well, it's interesting. It's kind of weird because up here in Canada, we can't patent a so-called higher organism, which is this kind of antiquated term to talk about a certain complexity of life. However, you can patent all the components of it. You can patent the genes and all the bits and pieces, but not the greater sum of its parts. So that does change the situation, which is probably a good thing up here in terms of de-extinction, where a patented mammoth, if it were going to be made and patented in Boston, but then moved up to the Yukon, you wouldn't be able to profit from it in the same way through the patent system.
Mm-hmm. So definitely some things to be keeping an eye on and monitoring. You've been researching this subject for many years, and you've just published your first book on the topic of de-extinction. And after everything you've learned, how do you feel about it now? Will de-extinction projects ultimately help animals and ecosystems on our planet, or are we headed down a slippery slope toward more animal exploitation and unnecessary suffering?
I'm concerned that there could be more animal suffering produced by this, largely from the amount of embryo and animal failure that occurs on the way to making clones successfully able to live. But I think the real value of de-extinction comes from applying these tools to endangered species, allowing for boosting of populations that are currently hanging on just by a thread and really need our help. There's a lot that we can do with genetic engineering to restore threatened populations, and that's going to be really cool to watch, because I'm not against this kind of directed evolution that bioengineering is allowing us to do. I just think it makes sense with animals where we know there's an available habitat for them now, and we can galvanize, get the right restrictions and legal protection to make sure that they are benefiting from conservation programs after we boost their genomes with more genetic diversity, for example. But yeah, I mean, it's not out of the question that some de-extincted animals could be made and then put in a zoo and stay there, whereas they need to only be in a zoo for a certain amount of time in order to be transitioned to the wild if conservation is the ultimate goal. So that's what people are hoping for.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
I'm so glad you were here. It was very fascinating.
Yeah,
I learned a lot.
Thank you so much. Thanks
yeah,
for having
thanks
me.
For coming into Good the chat. Studio on this rainy Vancouver day.
Where do you go next?
New York tonight.
Ooh, that'll be a nice
change. Yeah.
Hopefully it's not raining there.
It'll just be freezing cold.
Exactly.
And Rise of the Necrofauna is on bookstore shelves now.
Yep.
Right on. So everybody do check that out. Thanks so much for being with us,
Britt. Thank you, guys. Thank you.
And thank you to our producer, Elise, for producing this show. She's away today. You have been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM Vancouver. Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, unceded Coast Salish territories. Please join us here on the show next Friday, October the 27th. We'll be having a special show for you for Halloween coming up and World Vegan Day, featuring an interview with Dr. Michael Greger of NutritionFacts.org fame. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. You can visit our website at animalvoices.org, where you can stream past shows or download them as podcasts and get caught up on all of our past shows. There's lots there to listen to. You can also see our show blog there with detailed links, and also subscribe to us via iTunes. Stay in touch with us on Facebook at Animal Voices Vancouver, and we're also on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. So we'll be leaving you with a song now. This is appropriate for today's show. It's by Was Not Was. It's called Walk with the Dinosaur, or Walk the Dinosaur. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Picked up a monkey, skull to go. The sun was spitting fire.